Hi everybody, welcome to episode 66 of the Greater Than 11% podcast. This is our March panel episode where I'm delighted that we're welcoming Sam Conniff. So before we get speaking to Sam.
Hello.
Renee, let's take a look back over the incredible guests that you've had over the last few weeks.
Sure.
So shall we kick off with Nishma?
Sure, let's kick off with Nishma because she's your boss.
She is my boss. And actually I loved listening to her because it gave me great insight into my own boss. It was like a PDP session / window into my boss's mind that was great and made me really proud to work for such a trailblazer and also think about how lucky I am to have somebody like her around, given that she clearly didn't have someone, you know, that looked like her and was a woman in the industry and when she was rising up through the ranks. So I loved listening to her, and also I think she's just such a natural storyteller. It was a joy to listen to her episode.
Yeah, she's awesome, and she is really thoughtful and articulate about her experiences, and as you said, she's a storyteller, so she weaves it together beautifully that you kind of just hang off and you're anticipating what's going to come next, but she can often surprise. So that's really nice.
Yeah, exactly. I kind of wanted to send around the episode to the entire marketing floor because I think she pretty much laid out our 2020 strategy in a really brilliant way. So I might still do that.
Actually, I have to say her describing her role was epic. It's like 20 minutes.
Yeah. That first 20 minutes. I was,
at one point like, whoa, was this ever going to end?
It was a journey, but I enjoyed it. She brought it to life in a great way. Stephanie George,
yeah,
the dancing queen.
Yes.
Have to admit that I understood very little of the overall episode, but that's actually what I loved about it because it was so great to be immersed in such a foreign vocabulary. Sometimes it's really powerful to know how little you know about, you know, particular pockets within creative art. So I loved that about her. And also it really resonated with me when she talked about feeling somewhat silenced as a dancer and then pivoting into more kind of directing and working with actors. Mm. I love that angle that she brought to the episode.
I think as a kind of movement director or a movement coach or a movement teacher, I was thinking about it when I was talking to her and also when we were listening back through the edit, is that what she does, we interact with on a regular basis through cinema, TV, theatre, but it's such a hidden creative role.
Mm.
Like, I don't think many people would understand there is someone who works with movement of how you walk and carry yourself into a room. And I think that's fascinating because I think it is another language and it's not a language that's familiar to me either. So it was incredible to hear her talk about that and really kind of think about how she structures teaching someone else how to move, how to breathe, how to be.
Yeah, I agree. I thought that the way she described the kind of 3-year course that she taught was really interesting, with year one just figuring out who you are and then being able to find a language to be able to translate that into your movement. I guess we're much more familiar with concepts like body language, for example, but actually a lot of that falls into the same area, but it's used different terminology like contact movement, which I particularly enjoyed. And then we had Jay and Leah,
yes. Viva La Volva.
Yes.
Awesome women. It was such a fun episode to record. They're incredible and they're really focused on supporting others and thinking about how their creativity can be an outreach and be all-inclusive and not include a hierarchy, which obviously has so many difficulties in just working that out for yourself. Then as a duo, they've produced their second zine that's come out. Yeah, I got it last week. I absolutely love it. It's just awesome. And they're just, yeah. Jay's an incredible dancer. She had an amazing performance on the 22nd of February. And then Leah also is really interested in publishing in addition to her kind of production coordinator role.
Yeah, what an incredible group of women we've had over the last month. Moving on to more recent topical news such as coronavirus, which is obviously kind of top of mind at the moment. I actually have a quick recommendation for our listeners because I came across a really brilliant article that gave me quite a different angle on it. And it's called COVID-19, Both Danger and Opportunity. And it's actually been written by a fellow Googler and was published in the Nepali Times. The Googler explains how the Chinese character, which represents crisis, represents both opportunity and danger. And she's talked about the time that she spent in isolation as a really interesting journey of empathy, connecting with her family, valuing things that she didn't do before, and almost an opportunity to step back and kind of come to understand what matters most to her because she's been forced to slow down, which is particularly stark contrast to her life in kind of urban China, especially like the focus on working. And I just think it's a really interesting take on it. Or I don't know if you have any reflections on it or thoughts about it.
The last pandemic that really took hold took about a third of the human population with it, which is almost exactly the forecast that we'd need to avert climate crisis that we're heading towards. And is there some, you know, out there, not obviously wanting to make light of the difficulty and the death that's going on, but, you know, the ecosystem writes itself. And what would that be like, you know, and what, and almost as a very big philosophical, would you prefer 3 years of pandemic and a huge amount of loss versus 30 years of societal breakdown through ecological crisis? It's, you know, we're in those kind of, you know, it's all out of our hands, isn't it? And I, in a similar reflective way, I quite enjoy that almost powerlessness, because you begin to make very different decisions on what's important, and rather than fall into the hysteria of it being yet another great headline that's going to sell some papers, reflect on, you know, what matters to you and what would you do and what would you protect.
I mean, I agree with that. I kind of do feel it's the world writing itself.
Yeah.
And it needs to happen. I also like listening to the radio, like it's getting closer. It's like,
yeah. Yeah, yeah.
China, then it's like Italy, and then it's Austria, and then it's just like, oh, and a case in the UK, and I'm like, it's just slowly creeping towards us.
I took my two daughters to Tenerife last week, and the only thing that people have got to say is like, weren't you lucky you got out on time? And so it's like, you know, it's like one hotel with one incident in it. There's still three more deaths a day in the UK than there of peanut allergies. You know, we're so out of whack with it all. Like, did you watch The Avengers?
No. Should we watch The Avengers?
I'm sure someone listening watched. Did you watch Avengers, dear listener? Yes, right. Well, you know when Thanos kills half the world at the end of Avengers Endgame, and there's this kind of, everyone watching it was thinking, good solution, that's actually what we need, and someone else externally comes along and arbitrarily takes 50% of us out. It's the fastest way you get to the big problems, and that's one of the difficult solutions that we're unable to talk about. Where does actually proper family planning play a role in that kind of crisis? When you've got great big problems, you need to have great big conversations that address great big solutions, problematic as they are, and all the, you know, disproportionate as they will be felt.
I think for me, I know that we're in March now, so we probably can't keep going back to New Year's resolutions and thinking about the world from scratch. But I think a few things that have happened this year, the storms, coronavirus, us leaving the EU, all the political unrest in the Middle East, which I kind of got caught in as I was on a flight. But for me, it's made the world feel so much smaller. And I think many of the things that I took for granted all around globalization, borderless travel, for example, I think my imagination's ability to say, oh, I'll just hop on a plane and escape, feels suddenly by those things quite limited. And I think that's had interesting and unexpected effect on how I've been thinking and feeling, particularly over the last few weeks, because it just feels like, you know, even the weather has just meant that I haven't particularly wanted to go out because it's so horrible outside. And then suddenly the sphere of your movements becomes so much more limited. That's my thought for the day.
I think it's interesting with the floods, but also the bushfires in Australia. You know, this global kind of cultural move to have ownership, to own property, to acquire it, to keep amounting it. And yet the environment is just sweeping it away in one swoop because of our own, you know, made crises to the environment. But I think that whole notion of, ownership and property, I'm interested to see how that plays out as a result of these kind of extreme weather situations.
Yeah. And also I was listening on the radio on the way here actually to somebody talking about all the kind of global supply chains that are disrupted as a result of this, like shipping containers, for example. America now doesn't have enough shipping containers because they're not coming out of China fast enough, which then obviously has a massive knock-on impact to export and import, and that has a real impact to kind of small businesses who rely on that kind of free movement. And I think the power of individuals in terms of creating a global movement becomes a lot more real in this situation. So when you listen to the news, you start thinking like, should I start stockpiling things myself? Should I not get on the tube? Do I not want to go to work? Should I not get on that flight to get to an offsite, as an example? And then you realize, well, I did that, and then the collective impact of people that you know, and then the broader impact of that, and the kind of, it suddenly becomes much more real.
How we respond to fear, I think, is one of those things that define us. The Ukrainian health minister going and stepping into the environment where that entire village came out and defended themselves from their country fellows, that's insane, you know. So that took that kind of bravery versus, you know, the countries closing their borders immediately. Mm. And, you know, this is going to define what happens in all of these things, whether we turn that fear into something that's positive and we can all work towards, or we separate.
Yeah. So, Sam, you've already contributed to the conversation, but I am nevertheless going to... Sorry, that sounded really... you've already outspoken. You've already interrupted me twice. So I've had the pleasure of introducing you, Sam, many times, and your brilliant website describes you as an author, consultant, facilitator, speaker, author of Be More Pirate, founder of the incredible agencies Liberty and Don't Panic. You're a rule breaker at heart, but also, in my opinion, a phenomenal ally, friend, and father to your two amazing girls, Scarlett and Frida. And we met through the Marketing Academy, and I think, you know, you've been mentioned many times on this podcast before, so it's amazing to have you here in person. You've been a firm favourite of my Marketing Academy cohort, but also one of the first people that I'd call for help or an opinion or a quick point of view. And beyond pirates and your incredible book that I know has inspired incredible change among many different communities, you've also done so much in terms of giving people the courage and resilience to break rules and do something different. Something that I think is incredible about the work that you do and the presence that you have is that you encourage people that when something feels hard or difficult, it probably means that it's worth doing. And something that I've heard you say in many of your talks is that when you feel like you might be on the precipice of getting fired, well, then that's when you know that things are really starting to change. So I'm so delighted to welcome you on the podcast. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for that as an introduction. That's pretty amazing.
My pleasure. I could go on. Could go on for a very long time. But we, as I said, we've obviously worked together in a few different ways. But for our listeners, would you be so kind as to give an overview of what you do and why you love it?
I find that a little bit difficult at the moment. I was in the last place where I had a proper job today and remembering how much I loved it at Liberty, the agency that I founded with Michelle Clothier 19 years ago, and with the incredible young people that come through and feeling blown away. Such smart young people. And it made me really reflect how much I miss, you know, having a job. And so at the moment, I'm somewhere between being an author. I mean, your voice was slightly taking the mickey at the beginning of reading out the description on our website. And it's weird, isn't it? A series of non-jobs struck together.
I wasn't taking the mickey. I just think that when people get to know you, they know how shallow those descriptors are for what you do within words. And even if I would say you're a change maker or you're a disruptor, that would seem really superficial way to describing the impact on the people and the communities that you have. So they're accurate descriptions. I think other words describe what you do might be kind of like a portfolio career or a squiggly career, or but effectively, I guess, at the heart of it, you'll create change and inspire things to be done differently to how they are.
And yeah, I mean, semantics are important, all important, and I find it hard on the titling of it. I think the thing I'm proudest of probably is the book. So I'm an author, and I have really enjoyed being an entrepreneur, but I think that's a bit of a generic term that is filled with problematics. I got officially made a pirate, did I tell you that? Captain Tons, one of the few pirates that exists in the world today, there's about 200 of them, officially ordained me as a pirate. I have a certificate for it.
So how do you become officially a pirate, though?
The Brethren of the Coast have to gather, and there has to be a unanimous vote to allow you to join, especially if you're a landlubber like me.
I was going to say, have you pirated a ship? Have you taken command?
It's a special honour that's been awarded to me, like a kind of honorary degree, because of articulating the pirate narrative in a way that they failed to do.
I'm a bit jealous of that. I want that.
I've always had a chip on my shoulder about not having any kind of like qualifications and never been to university and all that. So now it sits on my wall where one of those bits of paper would have been.
Nice.
Renee, yeah, you need to write a book called How to Be More Pirate and make it better than Sam's book. And
I lived on a boat for 7 years, so I feel that qualifies me.
I did a workshop on a boat on Monday and I'm still shaking.
Are you?
Yeah.
you might need to take that certificate down.
I'm a pretty weak-kneed pirate. But if I start calling introduce myself a pirate, that would sound twatish as well. So I find it difficult describing. But I love it. I absolutely love it because I have an immense sense of the things that I've always been excited by, of freedom and of creativity. I really like that feeling when you're with a bunch of people who are, you feel a bit smarter than you, you're a bit out of your depth and you're on the crest of a wave of a good idea. Like that I really like. And I feel like I'm doing that pretty much every day, which feels amazing. I've got some really wonderful clients who've taken me on out of Be More Pirate work who are desperate to do ambitious change, the likes of which they haven't seen before. And for me, it's interesting because I'm not working with the kind of cool brands that Liberty got to work with, the Netflixes and PlayStations and Googles of the world. I'm working with something like FTSE 250, much more, you know, where your parents have got their pensions, where systemic change is really hard, but they're heavily industrialized manufacturing businesses where actually like impact on climate, etc., is a huge problem and change is much harder. So I'm getting another education in something completely new, as the book was an education in something new. And I'm also really enjoying the last year or so that I've done a lot of public speaking, which is how I've sustained myself. I did every single one of those incredibly nervous and feeling like a total imposter. And this year I've given myself a good talking to, like, get over yourself, stop feeling a bit apologetic or like it's a slightly, I don't know, lesser career, and I'm leaning into it and getting some training on it, and I'm really enjoying going into the scary place again.
Amazing. I can't wait to see what you, with training, unleash upon the world, given how amazing you were already. But that sounds pretty exciting.
Can I just interject for a minute? Why did you feel like you were an imposter and it wasn't necessarily for you, and how did you come, apart from saying get over yourself, how did you deal with that? Because I think that's really key.
I think I had a unfair and fixed prejudice of what an inspirational, motivational speaker is, like we all do, right? So we all fixed
voice.
Exactly. I obviously still have the prejudice because I couldn't say it without chipping it. Because, you know, maybe I do, maybe there's some justification to take the piss a little bit, because that it is a space that needs, you know, shouldn't be taken too seriously. Mm-hmm. And perhaps because I think there's an emptiness to it, and I want to be wary of that. And I know that I've been, you know, not always I've been at risk of stepping into empty space as well. You know, there's when you're not being completely yourself as you're exploring something new, I definitely found myself on stage, you know, more euphemism and trying to deliver a TED talk than I was actually being me. And I found that whole journey quite difficult, of finding who I am again under a spotlight, literally. And I felt that I was falling into the tropes of seeing how others did it, because that's how you do it. That's what we all kind of learn. You show up at anything new full of naivety and probably being the best you're ever going to be at it, and then you've got so long before you fall into the way that everyone else is doing it. And then having to watch myself and feel uncomfortable at being able to see that there you are pretending to be you. There you are with the veneer of what you think a public speaker is supposed to be. And realizing midway through the whole period that as a platform, actually, it's, you know, my whole career has been about some kind of impact. As a platform, it gives me a huge opportunity for doing. Stop denying it. Stop being embarrassed of it. Try and get good at it and own it. So that was a very hard and slow journey to get to. And for a while, I just ignored any compliment I would get about it. I thought, well, that's just because I'm, you know, doing this pretense version of it. So now I'm trying to understand the craft of it. And the training I'm doing comedy and improv and singing. And nothing scares me. I have no greater fear in the world than singing. None. I've done my third singing lesson. I haven't been able to say a word. I can just make noises.
Oh, I love that you're doing that. I've wanted to do like stand-up for a while, just to totally push myself with my comfort zone.
I'm terrified of that one too, but not quite as bad as singing.
But I love what you're saying, because it's about being vulnerable but also being present in the moment on stage and not projecting. I was at an event yesterday and someone asked a question, and it was about gravitas, and this amazing woman asked a question just very at the end, but we were talking about the difference in presenting and gravitas in relation to neurodiversity, disability, etc., and this expectation that it should look like a TED talk all the time. What is that about? And why do we keep projecting that, and that's the benchmark? Why can't we explore these different ways, these different ways of presenting and being, and also just have empathy around it's going to be different for different people.
Totally. And replace the stage with wherever you work. How often would you be able to watch a 20-minute video of yourself at work and think, that's genuinely me being me? And when I watch most of the videos of me doing talk, I'm like, that's not me being me. I'm doing a veneer of me, thinking I'm trying to be that person. And if you can then be the you you actually are, you know, how long are you going to wait before you step into being the you you're supposed to be? And that feels like an interesting challenge to me at this stage. I said to myself, I'm not going to do this if I ever stop being nervous going on stage. I'm not as nervous as I used to be. So I don't want to get comfortable doing something that's a bit of a veneer of me. So I live by that Eleanor Roosevelt line. If you really want to know what you should do next, you should understand what scares you most. And as soon as I said it, annoyingly, the singing thing came straight up. That's not balls. And I bet, just wrote down the name of Stephanie you were talking about movement. I went to see him at a speaker coach, and it's like, that's not quite the way I want to go. What I'm really interested in is these outlying edges of communication and language and body and comedy and how that all goes. Partly because the content I want to get into feels more difficult and darker than ever before, so the idea of bringing some satire and humour feels like a good balance.
Just you talking, actually, I feel really anxious in a good way, because that would be way out of my comfort zone. So I love that feeling when you're like, yeah, that is someone pushing themselves.
What's the most difficult, scary thing you could or should be doing that would take your journey further?
I definitely feel it would be being more vulnerable and open in a public forum, whether that be on a stage or within a group. Because I think you're right, we have these projections of our work selves or however we operate in the world. And I've definitely been on a journey peeling back the layers that I've either inherited or I've put up myself. And I definitely would like to explore that more, because I think there's real connection in that with other people and creativity.
And if you could put an even finer point on it, so we could ask you whether you'd go and do it, now you've decided what it is, what would it be?
I don't know, to be honest. I'd have to think about that.
I can put you in touch with my comedy guy.
Okay. And I'll put you in touch with Stephanie George.
Yeah, please. Yeah. I'd really like that. That sounds amazing.
Amazing.
What would yours be? What's the thing you could or should be doing, but you know you're not doing because you're scared?
I'd love to do the stand-up comedy thing. That too.
Yeah. I think we've talked, haven't we talked
about
that?
Yeah, yeah, maybe.
In fact, that would be it, is doing stand-up comedy, because that, one, I'm not that funny, and two, it terrifies me, the thought of having to stand up and like feel the pain of that like ultimate rejection from a crowd. Like, that to me is just like, oh, even in my gut now. But I also do really want to experience that. I want to feel what that feels like and know that I can survive it.
And imagine what not rejection would be like. I wonder what the percentage is, whether it's anywhere near 11%. I used to run a comedy club, and there's a huge issue with female comedians. Maybe you should do it. Maybe that's episode 68. These two on stage. Double act.
Oh, that would be great to do a live recording of us.
Yeah.
Of us, as he's not getting out.
Yeah, exactly. I think we should.
We're getting a comedy coach who can take you through it. Yeah. You do a couple of things, and you do a live show.
I feel like, as well, my dad never laughed at my jokes, and he constantly makes jokes. So if you're a kind of terrible punster / tell dad jokes like I do all the time, you're pretty used to just rejection and people not laughing at your jokes. So actually, that doesn't scare me as much.
Have you seen Maria Bamford perform to her parents?
No.
Do you know who Maria Bamford is?
No.
Name rings a bell, I'm not
sure. She's a comedian who had a psychotic breakdown and then was institutionalized. And she made a comeback in terms of setting up her own comedy sitcom, and she performs, and she is incredible. I think she's amazing. But she did a performance to her parents in her living room, and it's filmed. It's on Netflix. It's definitely worth a watch. She is brilliant, her writing, and she puts all her kind of vulnerabilities and her unwellness that comes and goes, because I think she's bipolar as well, and she loves pugs. I mean, what can I say?
Right up your street.
Yeah.
There's an overlap there then, isn't there? Vulnerability and comedy, because there's a darkness to it if it's going to be really funny, and there's a rawness to it if it's really going to be funny, and there's an uncomfortableness that you go on with really good comedians. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it.
Thanks, Sam.
So this podcast is all about creativity, as you know. So in the plethora of things that you do, what role does creativity play?
I have a take on this at the moment. After publishing the book a year and a half ago, Being a Pirate, I've been on this journey of doing talks that were initially very uncomfortable, and then they turned into a bit of a workshop, which was how can we be more pirate, and I pretty much made it up on the fly, and something came out of that, a response, something that took place in organisations, and I began to refine it and turn it into something good. And here I am, a kind of a year later, really reflecting on how did this, like what could be seen as a bit of a kind of trite story of pirates, actually take hold in so many important organizations and step into a space where people were talking about innovation and transformation and creativity. And so I began interviewing people. What was different about this? What made a difference? You know, what was it about stepping into this space? Why talking about rule breaking and pirates, actually, you know, rather than be comic roguish characters, took us somewhere really important. And the key responses, now if we've begun to get serious talking to organisations, are about an increase in productivity, increase in accountability, and an increase in creativity. And creativity is really interesting because it's related to risk-taking. So turn of the 21st century, we came into the century with business heralding creativity as the most essential skill for this entire 100-year period. Like, that was going to be it. I haven't yet been in an organisation, bar none, that says it values creativity, but actually it rewards conformity. And so it creates this kind of schizophrenia that, oh God, we've been told we need to take some risks around here, but actually I know if I need that job, I better do what I'm told. Mm-hmm. I better fit in, or I better do what they did. And so we haven't got to the grips with that schizophrenia. And so I've really studied what's been effective in all these sessions, and I've come up with a, and I know there's an irony to this, I've come up with a framework for rule breaking, because I think in that space of breaking rules and challenging the norms that take place in business, there is an opportunity for an increase in all of those things, and particularly an increase in creativity. And when you push on this, and I've kind of created this framework and talked about it a bit, I've been employed in places I never would have believed. Like, never would have believed that you could go and have a conversation about rule breaking, like, at all. And also, what I observe is the areas that people want to break rules in are go from the mundane and ordinary and admin right through to the big and the strategic. But it also disproportionately affects, as you probably would expect, the gender imbalance at work. And the vast majority of the people who put me in have been female senior leaders. And then there's an interesting thing when people are talking about either wanting to break the habits of technology or culture or whatever it is. Again, the voices that speak up and how things are affected and people are feeling affected is also disproportionate. So that it feels like there's lots of interesting things. I'm at very early stages with it, and I've just written a kind of chapter or two. It doesn't have a book deal or anything, but I'm trying to organise my thoughts, because with every session that I run, I'm feeling like, oh, wait a minute, I'm really onto something here.
Would you like to share any of the framework with us?
Yeah, sure. It's just about honesty. Like, the first question I've asked in all this is to give them an example of 101 professional rule breaking. Ask the most difficult question you can think of, like the most eye-wateringly embarrassing and awkward, difficult question you possibly can to the person next to you. Actually, let's play this game. Would you like to ask the person next to you the most impossible and difficult question you can?
No.
Come on. There you go. Right, there's the first response. That's what most people say. Would you like to ask Crystal a difficult and embarrassing question?
When have you felt the most vulnerable or experienced the most pain in an emotional sense? And you don't have to answer that, but that to me is the question I think I would ask.
Good question, by the way. No one ever says anything that good.
That's a great question.
So I usually give people about 90 seconds. Everyone laughs. You get some cackles. And then you kind of wrap it up thinking that we're all adults and most of you work together and know each other, right? This shouldn't be too hard. It should be a bit of a starting point. 5% of the room can usually ask a difficult question, and the majority of the room find it really embarrassing and don't say anything. Like, honestly, they spend the time cackling. And of those who answer anything, most of them have asked a question about when was the last time you had sex, or the more difficult one of, well, how much do you get paid, right? But if it's not sex and money, very rarely does someone say something emotional, seeking, and vulnerable as you've done, right? Very rarely.
My question would be, what's your biggest regret?
Also a good question.
That would be my question. Now I've had time to reflect.
It's fun to ask the question. It's interesting to hear some of the questions. But what's really important is that this plays out in everyone's day, and it's much less funny because you're in a room and you're being given the brief. And what you really need to say is that really the budget? Is that really the time frame? Or more importantly, is this what you really want to do? Or is this what you want to look like you're doing? Because this is going to determine the lives of the rest of us for the next 3 months. So tell us the truth. But none of us are able to say that for whatever the reason is. And there are obviously justifiable reasons. You feel more junior, or you don't feel that you've got a voice in the room, or maybe you're already in trouble, or whatever it is. And so we leave, and then we spend the next 2 weeks trying to find that out via a series of emails and secondary conversations until we just about fudge it together, and then there you go. And so in the sessions, we then coach people on difficult questions and we run a few things on it. There's 10 stages in this whole kind of professional rule-breaking framework, but if there's one thing I think that you could take away with you, your ability to do that, and I think it's like any other muscle, right? If you, 2 or 3 times a week, in those kind of sessions, find your voice, right? Find your space. And it's not always appropriate, I know, but you lean as much into the privilege or power that you've got and find your voice to ask the difficult question, and you feel like the biggest weirdo, pretty soon you'll be a hero. And undoubtedly, people will come up to you after that meeting with almost a guarantee and say, thank you so much for asking that. Thank you so much for that point of clarification. And then before you know it, 2-3 weeks in, a difficult question has become like an easy thing to do, and you're like, bang, 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 and it's like a superpower. So it's a small and slightly trite example of actually the bigger cultural things. I've done some surveys to back up these theories, because the risk is it's all just come from workshops that I've run, and so they're totally biased by my perspective. So I've done 2 big statistically accurate surveys. I'm leading up to a YouGov one on this question. In the last month, have you been in a meeting where internally you strongly disagreed with something that externally and verbally agreed with? Right? We've all been in there. Can you guess what the statistic was that said yes?
100%? 98%? Oh, sorry, that actually said something?
No, that did exactly that. That said they agreed while internally.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
70-ish%?
85, directly between both of you. Second question. Having agreed to the thing that really you'd like to disagree with, did you then go on and take any kind of action that sabotaged the thing that you said you did agree with? What's the percentage now?
I mean, personally, I would say, yeah, I do that. I don't know what the percentage would be, but yeah, I'm looking at Ursi as well, and we both know that.
So that's 50% of the room.
Yeah, personally, I don't, but I feel like everyone around me does.
When I say sabotage, I mean sabotage for the better, though.
Yeah. Whereas I just disagree in the room, and then it doesn't need to get
things. I disagree.
But
if you can't create persuasion, then I'm like, okay, and then off I go and do what I need to do.
Yeah. But that's actually something that I'm struggling with so much at the moment, because I think if, exactly as you say, some people will then spend 2 weeks kind of scurrying around trying to sabotage it. And effectively what happens is that any idea, good or bad, tends to die through a death of 1,000 cuts, because no one in that meeting will just say yes or no, or not enough people will just say yes, but let's sort that issue out and then disagree and commit. And that's what makes change, creativity, all those things that companies love to have as part of their value so difficult. And feeling like you're having impact or creating change on an individual level, really, really demotivating.
And that's why I think this notion of it being professional, right, because we've got to make the situation better, this is where most of us go every day, but rule breaking, because currently, and by rules I mean in the Oxford English definition of rules, is the norms and conventions that govern the places in which we work. So I'm not talking about the ISO frameworks or the Equalities Act, right, the things that are there to protect us, it's these. And the stats that I've got are, so 85% of us will verbally agree to something that inwardly we disagree with, and then 65% of those people will then go on to sabotage it. The average size of a meeting, 7 people, that means that you're going to interest one person in a whole meeting, and that includes you, like, not to fuck with the thing that you just all agreed that you were going to do that no one wanted to do. And that's normal, right? So there we are. We're already breaking the rules of the spoken social contract of work, and we all know it, yet it's unspoken. And so therein lies the space that I think I discovered in this pirate adventure, that we're so far away from, you know, creativity, bravery, all the kind of stuff that we like put out. So this dichotomy of dishonesty like exists all around us. And when you find the opportunity to step into it, something really interesting happens. And I know that the thing there is facing, it's really scary. And I think that's, again, the reason that I've been booked into the spaces I have by the people that I have. I think it's disproportionately scary, depending on who you are and the level of privilege you've got and how used you are just to speaking your bloody mind and whatever else. So I'm at the beginning of this journey, and I'm exploring it now, and I'm looking for opportunities to test it in different frameworks and workshop sessions, and trying to put the book together as an idea. But with each step I take, it's a bit like where I was with Be My Pirate, when you're just pulled towards something because there becomes a gravity, right? There's an idea in this, and there's an immediacy. You know, people will step out of their sessions, you've come up with these ideas for rules you're going to break, new things you're going to do, commitments. And so the feedback I get every day now is back in that place of emails. You know, I did it, I said the thing, I feel completely different, I got the answer, I got the high fives, you know, whatever that thing is. Once you've seen the world around you, you know, the dishonesty of it, and you've chosen honesty, then suddenly everything kind of falls away.
Can I ask you, in terms of your, I know your early days, but have you done any kind of research into kind of the games people play in terms of a psychological and pathological point of view?
What do you mean, sorry?
So, you know, roles that we put on and play out that we've either learnt behaviours and how that comes into play in those statistics?
Yeah. I've started that, so I'm looking at some of the different things, particularly around conflict avoidance and where that comes from, because a lot of it seems to go, you know, when you try and drill into it, what is it? And so there's a lot of kind of pathways that people have preordained that they're already on. So this is who I'm going to be, that's my idea of success, so that's where I'm going, and anything that knocks me off that, I'm not ready for. There's this really interesting notion about certainty. So we'd rather choose false certainty than be able to live in total uncertainty.
Yep.
So we'll accept, you know, real falsehoods around, you know, really unreliable material, because at least there's some pretense there that gives me, you know, rather than think I'm going to step off the edge of this altogether. And then the conflict one is just one of the most cited. I really just don't like, and I'll do it. I will justify not taking action to avoid conflict. So that one's in there. I think it's about 75%. Are you willing to do something you don't believe in rather than have a difficult conversation? It's huge. What are we doing? You know, the big challenges at the door are not going to be solved by the people who are supposed to solve them. The policymakers of the time that we're in are nowhere near to the large-scale erosion of democracy, crisis of identity, ecological breakdown, and it falls on business, really. I mean, large-scale business and the biggest impact it can have. And we've got no idea how to start having really honest conversations and be human beings in these places. And that then is disproportionate as you then look at the makeup of the organisation, because the less privilege you've got, the even less the chance there is of a really honest voice. So there's a real need for a big solution to come from this space, I think.
It's a certainty conspiracy.
That's a good way of phrasing it.
It is.
Is that already a thing?
No, I just came up with it. It should be a chapter heading.
Sure, let me write that down.
Yeah. Thanks. So bridging together all of our worlds, from Be More Pirate, professional rule breaking, and Greater Than 11%, are there any brilliant examples of women as original rule breakers?
Can I give the long answer?
Of course.
Thanks. So one of the things that I've dug into with this is, where is it supposed to come from? And it's in theory supposed to come from the top. And I think why the notion of rule breaking is so important, because the stats that I found when you combine the whole of Western Europe and Northern America for board makeups become really interesting, in that your average board makeup is 84% male, 94%, 92% white, 97% university educated. And the average age is 62 and a half. So your final decision maker of all the big stuff is 2.5 years away from retirement, white dude with a university education. And that's not to criticize or lay blame, it's to have empathy with where the final decisions are being made, and a group of people who have spent their entire life working towards a particular moment of success. And behind the scenes, I know many of these gentlemen and have worked with them, behind the scenes, after a drink or two or after a big session, the confession is, fucking terrified. Of course I know radical disruption is what's required. My daughters are on an XR march. I know that the business, I've seen the reports, but I don't fucking know what to do. I'm heading towards this precipice. Radical disruption, mate, on my watch. Leave it to the next guy. And so if Organisation X is going to decide to spend £100 million next year on making its manufacturing plant carbon neutral, because that's actually the thing that has to happen, that's the decision that needs to take place. And those guys are so out of the frame. So where the decision comes from, the generation that needs to break the rules and take some control, it's nothing less than a workplace rebellion that I think is required. So everybody sharing the feeling of frustration or empathy with some of the smaller kind of challenges that I'm saying, I think all this ladders in one direction. As soon as you get the muscle, ask the difficult questions, and that eventually leads to elegantly helping these guys lean the fuck out and take back control, to use that famous phrase, literally. And so, yes, my examples of this, which join the whole thing together, come from the world of pirates, where I've found so many inspirational figures that I think are worth drawing on. And my all-time favourites are the two female pirate queens, Anne Bonny and Mary Read, whose story is legendary, and as women in their 20s 300 years ago rewrote the rule book entirely of what a woman in leadership and a position of power could be at that time, where really outside the church there was no kind of, or maybe the queen, any kind of significance. And those two, I haven't got time to tell the entire story, but what they demonstrated from their kind of early lives, of their parents pretending they were boys so that they would be able to look after them, ending up in military service, ending up taking on the world, ending up as pirates, and then ending up taking on the Royal Navy, right through to this incredible bravery and demonstration, their stories spanning the world as sea shanties and penny operas, and just incredibleness. And one historian will go so far as to say the imagery of Anne Bonny, which is clearly there and in print and was at the front page of one of the most popular pirate books of the time, was found in Christian Delacroix's studio, the guy, of course, who painted Lady Liberty Leading the Brave that we know from Les Mis, which then, after being one of the most enduring images of female liberty at that time, informs the Statue of Liberty itself. So the undercurrent of these incredible stories of women not just challenging the rules but setting new precedents, I think, has a new importance right now, because we maybe lack the volume and vigour of role models that a generation of women deserve.
And if you'd like to find out more about those incredible female pirates, then people should buy your book. When I thought about some of my favourite rule breakers, some included people in this room: Renee, Sam, Chris, Nishma, my boss. Lots of people around me I think I admire often is to do with their rule-breaking tendencies. But I actually ended up thinking about Sheryl Sandberg, because I think she wouldn't necessarily come to mind as a rule-breaker, but I think we often take for granted Lean In as a piece of work that created a language and framework to talk about something that wasn't talked about with such an easy language before, an easy frame of reference, both in with Lean In and with Option B. I think they've given really important context to and languages for women to speak about challenges or ways to behave at work, and also around resilience and grief that comes through in Option B. And I think often we've seen through Be More Pirate and professional rule breaking, I know from the workshops that you've done with us, people often cite Be More Pirate, and sometimes you need that language or framework of that thing to make it live a little bit. And now, leaning in is just like a verb. We kind of use that all the time.
Yeah.
And I don't think we did that before. So even though she might seem quite corporate and not a rule breaker, I think at the time, Lean In and what she did was amazing. And I think she broke a lot of rules in writing about what she did and the way she did.
That's one of those, I mean, absolute accolades of success, though, isn't it? If you're term or phrase ends up becoming part of culture, like a Hoover moment,
yeah,
it does.
You see the same with terms like radical candor, or, you know, even challenger sales as a concept. Like, what's the challenger sale to this? Yep. People need the language of that to almost act like a bit of a barrier or skin that protects, means that they are still one step away from the thing that they're actually saying.
Can I interject, just because it's very topical and it's slightly off what we're talking about, but Harvey Weinstein has just been convicted, and talking about rebelling and professional rebelling and rule breaking, the Me Too movement was exactly that. Few key individuals took huge risk, which was long overdue, and finally we see some comeback on that.
I thought that exactly when I was reading your notes, because I'd just been, you know, the thing was just announced, and the woman who was his assistant, and, you know, the fucking pushback that, you know, he then gives, you know, Jesus Christ, this woman's in a, you've so abused your position. But actually, in the moment, for her, it wasn't seen as immediately as, you know, inappropriate sexual misconduct. It was seen as within her professional boundaries to keep her, you know, so actually to speak up in that moment, it is exactly that. The rule breaking that's required in that moment is of the bravest. And because the movement that it then brings will mean industrial shifts, and hopefully not just in that industry, but in the others that it needs to as well.
Definitely.
And could you talk a little bit more about how you see if any differences in the way that people respond to rule breaking as a concept, whether it be from different cultural backgrounds, different levels of education, gender differences? Like, what have you seen through the workshops that you've done?
Yeah, I do see a difference. I haven't seen as much culturally as I would have expected. You know, having run them in Germany, I thought no one was going to get it, and I was like, fucking hell, we need this. And then being in America, you're like, hey, we're over this, and, like, you know, still no more than 5% of people can ask a difficult question. Certain types of organisation feel a bit more rebellious than others. And when it comes to the, because of the nature of it, we've only got a few hours together, so you don't get to the Me Too moments immediately. You get some very profound and interesting ones. Often they will start with slightly more administrative things, like the way meeting culture is around here, or the pressure to respond digitally. And yeah, and I think there is a difference. I think that there's a gender bias, and I think there's an age and experience bias to it. And so if you're a younger woman in an organization, the pressure on you to respond within 24 hours, and I've heard it said countless times that it feels like there are older blokes who will show up to meetings late, you know, not need an agenda, speak over everyone and be willing to leave. And it feels very, very hard to speak up and have a voice when we've got an equal contribution to make. And it becomes this kind of power play thing. Like, that's no way for anything to run. And it's like terrible habits from a bygone age, and, you know, arguably not as bad as some of the things we were just touching on. But nonetheless, it still smacks of privilege and the old, you know, the whole kind of patriarchal system that sits behind so many of our organisations. And so those, I think, are really interesting, and that those consistently come up. And that, you know, probably 90% of the people who booked me has been through a, you know, a senior female leader at work discussing this. So the clear need for pushing through some of the rules is obviously seen through a different lens. And I'm proud of that. I think that's something to really, really continue to push at. And I haven't seen it more starkly within identity or ethnicity backgrounds, but I'm guessing, I'm hypothesizing that it's exactly there. And so the work of it will be even more important as we kind of continue to push into it.
I think also risk-taking is an interesting concept in terms of what people have to lose.
Yeah.
I think the level of privilege or background or your socioeconomic status, or like whether you're a carer, if you have people depending on you, whether that's children or elderly parents or whoever, I think that really impacts the kind of your risk-taking elasticity in a way, right? Because actually, whilst everything within you may want to speak up and challenge that person and in that room change things up, but in extremis, the outcome might be that you do get fired if you're in an organisation where they may not respond well to that.
Yeah.
And the so what of that is that you might get a disciplinary, or you might lose your job, or you might not get a promotion. And guess what? That means that you might get paid less or lose your job, and then that has an impact on somebody beyond you. Sometimes it can be the courageous thing not to do that, even though what everything that we're talking about within this is like, you know, you tend to associate courage with risk taking.
I think about that quite a lot, and I was put on the spot with that, talking about being a pirate and showing the way. And I thought it was useful for me to show, here's how I've applied it to my life. So I'm just not some inspirational speaker telling you about my book. It's like, here's how I've actually lived the principles that I want to talk about. And then it was pointed out to me once by a young woman. I remember it actually vividly. And she says, it's easy for you to say that. It's easy for you to do all those things. You're a 40-year-old white man, like middle-class white man. And it really stopped me in my tracks. And, you know, as proud as you describe me, and I'm sure it's not how I'm described on my my website as an ally, but it made me think, you know, actually, where do I sit and all of that? And it's made me think about it a lot. And as one of the reasons I got to that idea of success being nearly getting fired, because I wouldn't want anyone to lose their job over this kind of thing. But every time I've run these sessions, there's the same pattern, which is at the first, the people who put me are like, oh, terrified, what are you going to do? Talk about mutiny and rule breaking. Gosh, where's this going to go? And at the end, the room has come up with ideas way more than the emptiness of the words like innovation and transformation now get us, because we walk into it assuming that we're all going to talk about it, but really go back to our desks and do the same fucking thing we've ever done. So because the avaricious nature of the invitation goes that much further, actually you get at least a few points further on, because we're now talking about rule breaking. So the invitation feels like it takes you further. And what I've got to is, my feeling now is, if you can understand the level of privilege that you've got, or at least have a degree of awareness of it, then you can lean into it to the right degree. So if you know that you are under pressure, or you're new in the position, which are also aspects of privilege, or you feel that you're in a minority voice in the room, so you need to watch out, or whatever it is. But I feel I have a massive amount of privilege, so I need to actually, I should have been leaning further and opening more doors in the stuff that I was doing. And that was really the biggest challenge to me. It wasn't, oh, I got away with it because of who I am. It's like, fuck, I could get away with a whole lot more, and I can open more doors and take more people with me.
I imagine that even within the invites that you get, they're probably still in the like top right quadrant of risk appetite as businesses. Even the least progressive, least risky, welcoming, like ultimately to have you, I know this is a big assumption, but it'd be like, well, they have budget to get people in, or they have been to an event where you have been there, right? And so I think even if we think about outside of the corporate sphere, if we think about somebody who works for the Royal Mail or in a cafe or does lots of different jobs, whatever it might be also reframing rule breaking, not just within the context of your work, right? And thinking about what else you can attach to so that it doesn't all hang on your employer as the key channel to make change.
Yeah, habits and norms that you're conforming to. What is the daily mundanity that you're allowing to define your role, and that, you know, whatever aspect of that is killing your soul, to use a phrase that you introduced me to. And I would have assumed, yes, it was going to be your more kind of creative organizations. Hey, let's get in the next person who's got an interesting book. And so that's one of the reasons I've wanted to push back and interrogate it so much. And it's, you know, the work I'm doing most deeply at the moment is with a FTSE 250 monocrop agri business, you know, that's a PLC whose bottom line is so dependent on so many variables, like the last thing they can do is take risks, and they're so lent in. IOSH, the world's biggest health and safety membership body, bar none, has lent into it to create safety pirates, because they know that health and safety has gone so far in the wrong direction, we need to take care of it. We're just doing some work with Macmillan Cancer around the hugest taboo of sex for pleasure whilst having cancer, because no one can talk about it. They can't get people to talk about it. The largest single group of mutineers is within the NHS. Rule breaking in the NHS, it feels really difficult, but there's no other way. We've got to fix this precious thing, but then following the orders. You know, we can see it all around us, and when you realise, or you're willing to admit that the game is rigged, then you carry on following the rules, and you're playing to lose. And this is scary, and that's the thing of it. And whether you're working in a cafe and it's doing things a bit differently, but typically the people with the closest proximity to the problems are trusted the least to deal with them. And we've centralized power to understand everything that's going around you, which has become an impossibility. So we've become, you know, dealers in sound bites, and you've got all the people delivering it, and yet they don't always have power to make decisions on it. And I think we're going to find pretty quickly over the next few years there has to be a fairly radical decentralization of power in organizations if we're going to have the type of firms that we need in the middle of the point of the 21st century, because quite clearly the ones we've got have delivered worse than fuck all. You know, the biggest of the crises we face can all be directly linked to the kind of economic model we've had, and the acceptance of that is more widely spoken about than I've ever experienced. And this has been my topic for the last 20 years, from the overstated Larry Fink letters to the Lionel Barber, the editor of the FT, front page letter calling for it, to the Economist. And of course there's a danger with that lot, because they're suggesting that capitalism is the solution to capitalism, but nonetheless, you know, we haven't been at this point of a level of acceptance that it needs a rethink. And the danger is they're not offering the rethink, so where's it going to come from? It's not going to come from the center, it's going to come from the edges. So look out and look over the edge.
So something that you often reference, Sam, is that with the world doesn't need any more inspiration, but it's now time for action. So in the spirit of that, I would love to do a quick whiz round to ask you each to give an example of a time where you've broken a rule and talk about how it feels, because it's often shrouded in language of triumph and courage, but it can sometimes feel quite uncomfortable. So I'd love to give our listeners a glimpse of that. So Renee, are you happy to kick off?
Sure. So I think as an artist, you're constantly breaking rules to try and find an avenue or a place for your creativity or responding to something. I have definitely taken some risks or rule breaking in my creative practice. And it's really interesting. Stephanie George, she talks about it in her episode. Her biggest challenge is always disappointment, where she feels like she's made her best work and it's not received. And the aftermath of dealing with that, I think, is one thing. But also when you take those risks, you break rules, you make something, you then have to deal with the repercussions of that. And the success and the big wins and the achievement might come way down the line. And there's that kind of gap in between. So I definitely have taken risks, but I am really interested in that lag between doing a risk, taking a leap, breaking a rule, and then being able to look back and enjoy it.
And Sam?
Heading into the Christmas holiday, I had the majority of the holiday with my daughters, and I was really looking forward to it. I was really aware how hard I'd found it to be present in the latter part of last year. And walking home with them from school, I just instinctively deleted all the social media apps off my phone. And I haven't, where are we now, March? I've enjoyed it so much. About 4 weeks ago, I just deleted Gmail as well. So I now have no email, no social media. I've only got WhatsApp and text messages and phone and like camera and Uber. The thinking time that's returned, like at a bus stop or wherever, pause moment, like waiting downstairs, you reach your phone. I'm like, I'm checking my bank balance. You know, because there's like such a desire. Yeah, and so then you end up daydreaming. And then you end up wondering. And I've like written book proposals in my head. Like it's amazing. It's a gift to have your imagination back.
What about you, Crystal?
A recent example of a time where I broke a rule was probably in going for the job that I currently have. Sam actually consulted me. Consulted is the wrong word, but Sam helped me through that a lot, actually, because the role that I have now didn't exist before, but there was an opening for someone much more senior than I am as they went on to maternity leave. And so the risk that I took was I sent an email to the managing director of Google and head of marketing and said, hey, I think I'll be amazing for this role. And I know I don't fit any of the criteria on the job description, but I think I'll be incredible. So can you think of a way for me to take the role? And so I did, and now I have it. So that's an example of what I took, which sounds great and glamorous, but was fraught, as Sam very well knows, with a lot of anxiety and worry, and is this the right thing? And am I making a total fool of myself? Do I look arrogant? Am I going to be good enough? Am I not? We did go through all of those unglamorous parts of making, of taking the risk and breaking a rule, but it paid off.
Yeah, there's a theme, isn't there, being uncomfortable, I guess, in sometimes breaking rules, or feeling very comfortable and being able to daydream.
Yeah, totally. And you know, it always sounds good when you then say it back, right? Mm. But every success is, you know, prefaced by a fucking great mess. And when you're like all good art, like when you're there amongst the mess and you're making some good stuff, it could well be a good sign, rather than shy away from it and try and quickly organise everything, as we're prone to do, to explore it further. And that's, I think, you know, what was so admirable about you was that you held yourself in a space of not knowing for quite a long while, which is why I think you got to the better solution.
We just generally don't talk enough, I think, about the difficulties that sit behind taking the risk, doing the thing that makes you look great, getting the awards. You know, there's always that fear of rejection. There's always the anxiety around it. But we just, there aren't as many forums, unless you're really explicit about it all the time, to talk about it. So we can't let our March episode go by without mentioning that it is International Women's Day this month on the 8th of March. So I'd love to ask you all, how do you feel about International Women's Day and what are you doing to celebrate it?
It's one of those things I think I feel slightly difficult coming into. I was brought up by a house full of women, and all the businesses I've had have been successful because they've been, you know, mostly run by brilliant female business partners, and Be More Pirate is about to be taken over by incredible Alex, who's
an incredible woman.
Incredible woman. But it's really easy to feel a bit like, you know, that ally statement, like token, or I might, like at Liberty we used to do this big kind of display and everyone would put up the woman that they thought, and so it's like, I was always and so I've kind of, as I've got to this point of like privilege, like, are you really doing enough? Does this feel a bit token? Have I put on Instagram the person that I respect the most? And so I'm open to some inspiration. For me now, really, in the last couple of years when I haven't had a proper job, it's very much about my daughters and making them really aware of what this means, and for them to think about it. And we've got all the right books, you know, Rebel Goodnight Stories for Girls. And my daughters clearly have got some very, you know, strong female role models that they have that I know that my sister didn't have at that age. So it'll be discussions in our house and talks about them.
Yes. So we've got loads of activity going around. So Greater Than 11% is in collaboration with the amazing Mary Continenza, motion graphics designer. And she and I have been collaborating and creating a load of content to go out around the 8th of March. Ursie and I are just about to set off to Edinburgh to catch some interviews with some Scottish female creatives. So we're extending our reach beyond London, which has been one of our aims. And then we've got our second Greater Than 11% on the 11th of March, which is on visual storytelling. So we've got the amazing Marilyn Ford doing the workshop for the first half. And then we've got Candy Gard and Emily Chen, who will be on the panel talking about their careers and their creative kind of process and their work. And finally, I will be shouting about all the awesome women that I love and think are incredible, like I do every day, because International Women's Day isn't just for one day.
I have a similar sentiment to you, Sam, around International Women's Day, and any regular listeners to the podcast will know what I'm referencing here when I say that I have a similar view on International Women's Day as I do to kind of Valentine's Day, in that diversity and inclusion is something that we should be thinking about and pushing for every day. But if there's a tentpole moment or a date in the year that helps move that forward, create connections, showcase brilliant people, create opportunities for learning and sharing, then I am all for it. But progress needs to happen every day. It's in the small, bold actions, as you would say, Sam. And that's what's going to help us move that 11% number and the 200 odd years it's going to take to get to pay parity across the genders at a global level. In terms of what I'm doing, I'm actually at an event for The Fold, which is an incredible clothing brand all about empowering women. So I'll be hosting an event on the 4th of March where myself and two colleagues will be facilitating an I Am Remarkable session. I may have mentioned I Am Remarkable before, but it is a workshop created by a Googler called Anna Vayner. And it's all about empowering underrepresented groups to celebrate their achievements in the workplace and beyond. So that is how I will be contributing to and celebrating it. And I may even reinstall Instagram to shout out some of the amazing people, women and allies that I would like to celebrate this International Women's Day.
That was exactly what I was looking for on that point, because I share exactly the same thing. I feel pretty, you know, like I would advance the cause in any given day and do try to. So why do I we didn't have to have a day, but then of course give us a moment of celebration and give something. So what I think I was looking for was not feeling tokenistic on here's the woman I most respect. And you've just given me a really good bit of inspiration between the practicality of both of those suggestions. I've just totally remembered a woman, one of my largest clients, and she runs the Women's Network, and she's missing a couple of big strategic gaps to want to really activate the network. And so I Am Remarkable is exactly what she needs. And then I've got two other ideas. So I'm going to volunteer and go and spend some time with her to help use my knowledge and context to bring that Women's Network within that very large organisation that desperately needs it to life.
Can I just say you're awesome, Sam? Thanks so much for coming today. It's been a really great episode.
Thank you. I've really, really enjoyed it. I think it's bloody marvellous.
Sam, thank you so, so much for joining us today. I can't wait to see people's responses to this episode, and we've had a great laugh, all four of us today.
I'm really honoured to be on. I couldn't feel more strongly about the topic, and thank you very much for having me here in this month and amongst this conversation particularly. So thank you very much.
And just remember, dear listeners, if you are enjoying Greater Than 11%, please leave us a review and tell your friends, colleagues and family about us. Our mission is to explore roles and opportunities within the creative industries and shift that statistic that only 11% of creative directors are in the UK by shining a light on brilliant women. So please rate us, share, talk about us. The more the better.
Do it now.
Do it now.
'Clap in the woods, isn't it, or whatever that is? It's a clap in the woods. No, it's
not. The tree falling.
Yep.
I think it's the bear in the woods, isn't it? But it's not a clap.
I still don't know what you're talking about.
If someone gets clap in the woods, does it really count?
So
that's cool.
Let's crack on.
That's the polite version.
Okay, we better start. We're never going to start.
We are never going to start. Welcome everybody to episode 66, which we all think is an auspicious episode number in a good way. And today I am very excited to welcome as our panel guest, Sam Conniff.
Hello.
What?
I said hello.
Oh, I thought you said no.
No, hello, thanks for having me.
I thought you were like, no, you can't say that.
No, I was just being polite.
Okay.
I'm glad to be here.
I'll do that again.